What is the basis of a healthy society? Is it an individual or is it the family? What happens when families break down, and what is the relationship of family breakdown to government? Joining us to answer these difficult questions is Colin Smothers of the Center for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. He's also with the Kenwood Institute in Louisville. Colin, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Richard. Honored to be here.
Hey, you and I are on the same page when it comes to looking at culture and the big questions of the day, things like the family and the importance of family. And we look at these issues from a biblical perspective, the reality that there's a God who creates us in his image, a God who came up with the idea of marriage and family. And these are something that we hold to be true. And yet we live in a society that doesn't necessarily think the way that we do. And we're going to try to unpack some of this. So I want to go to one of the things that you and I agree on, and people in the church agree on. And that is that the family is considered the most important unit of society. It's a God-ordained institution. Marriage is God-ordained. It's one man and one woman. They come together in a covenant. Children come from this union. Parents train and teach their children how to live, how to behave. They're passing down values to them. So family's the primary socializing agent. They influence the values, the beliefs, and behaviors of their children. They provide emotional support, economic stability, and a sense of identity. But as I just said, not everybody agrees with that. So let's start with that. We're in a postmodern culture where we're not all on the same page. So how do we approach it? We have very strong convictions here, biblical convictions. How do we start from that perspective, that not everybody is thinking the way we do?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, Richard. I think fundamentally we have to recognize that the family is the most basic and natural experience known to man. I mean, all of us, whether we were born into broken families or intact families, we are all the product of a father and a mother. So right there, you have the definition of a family, a mother and a father and a child. And according to God's design, the family is founded on the institution of marriage as he designed it, which is between one man and one woman. And that's the procreative context in which the family is created. And, you know, you go back to the very beginning in Genesis 1 and 2, and what does God create? God creates the man first. And I think importantly, what God says about Adam, the special creation of the first man, he says, it is not good for man to be alone. So what does he do? He brings him a woman, which she answers Adam's aloneness in one sense, but then their procreative act together brings forth children, which brings forth through the generations the human family. And so right there, you have the basis of human society, marriage, family, on through the generations. And it's really belonging to a particular family that joins us to the human family. And I think you already mentioned this, Richard, but even the idea of human dignity and human worth, I think it's tied to the definition and the purpose of the family. And I think what's eroding today is not only, sadly, our foundations of the family, but what does it mean to be human, created in God's image, male and female? And I think we should certainly start there.
So Colin, well, let's go to the individual. Some would argue, I think the libertarian mindset would say, really, the basis of society is the individual. It's their freedom to pursue whatever they want to pursue. It's a non-existent or a very small state that would provide parameters for how people should live. How would you address that? People would say that it's really the individual. It's not the family.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's a great irony here in the political reality that we face today, where you have a hyper-individualism. And that is sort of counterbalanced by a hyper-communitarian impulse. And I want to unpack that a little bit. I think it's actually the horseshoe theory where both the hyper-individualist, we're talking about extreme, you know, libertarian views, and the hyper-communitarian or the totalitarian, I would say, the one who sees this society as a whole as the only, you know, relevant political actor, both of them their political approach destroys the natural family and our natural bonds as men and women, sons and daughters, brothers and sisters, etc. And so this is the irony. You go back to philosophical movements started by Rousseau, by Kant, and then on through even more political philosophies. For instance, what Karl Marx and Engels, his disciple there, what they're doing is they are intentionally attacking the family because they want this hyper-individual to relate directly to the state. And so I know you and I have talked about this, Richard, that what the family is and the function of the family is able to be a bulwark both against statism, totalitarianism, and this hyper-individualism. And you see both movements in today's culture attacking family from both the right and the left, but they both have the family's demise in mind. And, you know, going back to Marx's theory, the reason why he did not like the family is because he had this hang up about private property and the way that private property would pass down through the generations because of inheritance. I think you could overly psychologize Marx's experience. He had bad relationships with his own father, bad relationships with his own kids. You know, a lot of these liberal progressive philosophers, you wonder if they're just justifying, you know, their own sort of miserable existence. But Marx is coming at the family and he's trying to undermine the family. He wants to abolish the nuclear family for his own political ends. And I think right there is the seed form of what we see coming at our society today against the family.
That's good. You know, Colin, one thing, if I could add to this, that's in common between hyper-individualism and hyper-communitarianism is that they divorce God from the individual, God from the idea of family, and God and the role of government. That's the commonality. And I think we're experiencing both today in our society, in Kentucky and in the United States, where you have this hyper-individualism that's probably expressed best in this gender ideology that says to a person, you can transcend your biologically born gender. That's the extreme. And many people are rejecting that. They know that there's something wrong. Even non-Christians realize that that doesn't add up, right?
Absolutely.
But then you have the other side, this hyper-communitarianism, where you see this impulse by some on the political left primarily that are saying, hey, if there's a need there, the government can fill that need. If you don't want to get married, that's okay. The government will help you with some kind of financial assistance. If you need childcare, the government will step in with a pre-K universal childcare program. Whatever it might be, education and paying for tuition, the government will step in. So you have that hyper-communitarian impulse. And I guess here's what I'm thinking. How much longer can society continue with both of these extremes pulling against one another? Is there some kind of a breaking point somewhere? I'm just kind of curious. We have both of these realities in tension, but in existence, very, very prevalent, very, very clear to us that they're alive and well here. Where are we going with this? I guess that's the question. Where do you see this ending up?
Yeah. You know, with the disintegration and the really the demolition of the nuclear family and family as this pre-political, you know, God-ordained institution, the basis, the fundamental unit of human society, that begins to break down. And it's not just where society is headed, but will we have a society in the future? I mean, you look at birth rates, for instance, they are cratering in the West. We are below, our natural citizens are below replacement rate, which is 2.1 children per individual. We're somewhere around 1.7, 1.8. If we didn't have, you know, influx in immigration, our population would already be declining. In other words, you undermine and you abolish the family, which is what many on the left are attempting to do. You don't even just have, you know, what's the future of society look like? The question is, what does society look like at all? Will there be a human society at all? And that, I think, is the concern.
So, Colin, besides our replacement rate being at 1.7, 1.8 children per woman, we're also seeing family formation isn't happening. Marriage rates are much lower.
And delayed. Marriage is delaying. Yeah.
Some people aren't marrying at all. So that's an issue as well. Have we as a society given up on that idea of family and part of the in marriage and part of the idea of marriage is to bring into existence that next generation of children to train and to teach and to pass our values on to them? Have we lost this idea?
You know, I'm hopeful in some of the things that I've seen recently in cultural trends, but certainly the latter half of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century, it seems like, at least in the West, our impulse was either statism or hyper-individualism. And I think both explain how you have the reduction or the dissolution of marriage and family, because you are either on this sort of self-creating, hyper-individual, you know, I am going to be the self-expressive individual of my own destiny, author of my own destiny there, choose your own adventure, regardless of nature, regardless of who my parents are, regardless of where I was born, the customs I was born into, the family, et cetera, I am going to determine my future on the sole basis of just my own self and my own feelings. You have that. And on the other side, you have this, again, this hyper-communitarian statism, totalitarianism, that says, I can look to the state for those needs that in throughout human history has basically been met by mothers and fathers, grandparents, local communities living together in human society. And so both of them, both of those trends, that hyper-individual self-expressivism and looking to the state in the totalitarian state meets all my needs, and I am just an individual relating to, you know, my state. Those have both been very destructive for marriage and family.
Colin, we're seeing the impact on children when mothers aren't married to the children's father. We're seeing a great impact on mental health. There's very high rates of anxiety. In fact, Jonathan Haidt wrote a book called The Anxious Generation, and he talked about many of the mental health challenges and issues that younger people are facing today. They don't have that the role model of a father. They're not growing up with the moral boundaries, if you will. Expectations on young boys haven't been placed on them. So they're struggling. By the way, it's about close to one out of three children today in the United States are in single parent households. So we're seeing the impact on mental health. And is this, and then I guess to extend further, the state steps in. If there's nobody there to provide for mental health needs, where do you see the role? So the state isn't the only player in this. What about the church? The church has something to say, of course, about what we're talking about, what constitutes a family and marriage and what it means to flourish as a human being. What do you see the role of the church in this, especially as young kids are suffering?
Yeah, this is where I think we have to, as Christians, as evangelicals, have a robust understanding of natural theology. What is right according to God's good design, originating in Genesis 1 and 2? And that is a man and a woman married for life, having children, creating families that create families and fill the earth. In a post-Genesis 3 world, however, there are the realities of sin. And sin is the reason why families break up, why marriages break down, these kinds of things. And it's why in the Old Testament specifically, you see a pervasive concern by God, by his commands to his covenant people, to have concern for the orphan and the widow. What is an orphan? What is a widow? It's someone whose family structures have broken down. Father and mother are no longer in the picture. Husband providing, no longer in the picture. And what's the command there? The command specifically is to the covenant community to care for the orphan and the widow, really to be, as God is, a father to the fatherless. And there you hear that familial language. It has a familial shape. Even as we recognize the deterioration, the breakdown, we are filling voids that, according to God's good design in Genesis 1 and 2, are still there. And I think that's one of the things that has happened not only with the state, but also the church. We recognize these tragic cases where family life, marriage life breaks down, and we begin to normalize that or make room for that experience instead of recognizing no, there is God's good design. Yes, there's been a Genesis 3 situation and sin that has broken that down. But what do? We try to approximate according to God's original good design. And that is certainly something that the church should be involved in.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you.
Colin, those are fantastic points to bring up. I'm going to add something else to this. What happens when the state redefines what constitutes a family? Specifically, what happens when the state redefines what marriage is? And that's what they did in 2015 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that marriage is no longer necessarily between one man and one woman covenanted together for life. And that's what they said in the Obergefell decision. What do you do when the state is redefining a creational ordinance of marriage? Where do we go from there? I mean, have the seeds been sown already for the destruction of the family, or is there, what do we do? Where do we go from here on? That was 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that we're still dealing with the consequences. You know, I think one of the first responses that Christians can have, you know, to quote Psalm 100, verse 5, we are not self-created, but we are God-created. It is God who made us, and we are His, the sheep of His pasture. We do not get to define ourselves. We are not self-creating beings. We are authored. We are created by a benevolent, good God who made us male or female in His image. So that's the starting point. So I think the first response to a government that says, this is no longer what marriage is, and marriage is defined this, this, and this way, is to say, you don't actually get to do that. You don't have the right to define an institution that God Himself made, that God Himself designed. We are all men and women under authority. That includes our governmental authorities. And there, I'm sorry, but you know, Justice Kennedy in the Casey decision, who said that every individual part of liberty is the right to define your own reality, that is absolutely insanity. That is the definition of nihilism, actually. So no, that is not our right. Yes, I am a free creature created in God's image with certain inalienable rights, and I'm thankful for all that. One of those rights is not the right to define myself that I am a cat and I live in a green world with lollipops all around. That I'm sorry, that is not my prerogative, my role as a creature. And so I think that's the first part that Christians can, the starting point that Christians can take is we are created. And we are created by a creator who defines reality. And we teach our government to do that, not only with our personal lives, but also in the way that we vote, also in the way that we act as citizens and in human society.
So the church has a role in saying these things. The church has a role in discipling their congregations about creational ordinances and about reality and who God is and who we are made in His image. And Colin, you said that human dignity is predicated on being made in the image of God. And that is the idea that there is male and there is female. And when they come together in a marriage, it points to fulfillment in their lives, procreation and family. These are theological propositions. So how do you respond? And I am in full agreement with you, by the way, but how do you respond when somebody would say, Colin and Richard, you're imposing your theology into public policy?
There are two books that God ordained and authored, revealed. There's the book of Scripture and what theologians call the book of nature. And guess what? There's concordance between the two. What God reveals as our special dignity as human beings is obvious and apparent in creation. Humanity stands apart from the rest of creation, and that's self-evident. That is evident according to reason. Also, the Bible says that God created us male and female in his image. You look at the scientific evidence, you look at the book of nature, as it were, and what do you see? You see males and females. To answer your question, Richard, you don't have to have the Bible for you to be able to recognize that there are males and there are females. And we see this, I think, written very well articulated in this recent Trump executive order on gender. He didn't have to make any recourse to the Bible. He could have. He didn't have to, because this is what the science says.
And most Americans agree with that. I think maybe we've been in a period of disbelief just regarding gender ideology and gender confusion, and that boys should be able to compete against girls in sports. And there has been a tremendous backlash against those policies. Colin, if you were in the Trump administration and you were advising them, if you had a seat at the table and you were able to suggest a few provisions that would support families and support the notion of marriage, regardless of the Supreme Court ruling, what would be a few things you would do to help elevate and strengthen the family as far as federal policy is concerned? Have you given any thought to this?
Yeah, I mean, just off the top of my head, I think what you want to see as an outcome, you incentivize. You don't disincentivize. So I think that you incentivize marriage. You incentivize children, having children. So I think, for instance, Vice President Vance coming in, at least on the campaign trail, was very clear that he wanted to up, for instance, things like child tax credit per child, amounts that you can deduct from your tax, or even as a some kind of a stipend from the government, et cetera. I'm don't get me wrong, I'm a conservative, small government type of a person, but when we're talking about our high income taxes, high state, high local taxes, ways to ease the burden. It is expensive to raise a child in America. Ways to incentivize the having of children, ways to incentivize, for instance, a household that can make it on one income, doesn't have to have two parents out working, but there can be one parent at home caring for the children, especially in the young years. These are the kinds of policy things that I would say the government needs to take a close look at and to see what is it that we are incentivizing. What is the ideal human society? And that is intact marriages, growing families that are going to be making literally the next generation and on down. So incentivize what it is that you want to see. Marriage, procreation, family.
Colin, those are very good suggestions. I couldn't agree more. However, those aren't sexy policy proposals when it comes to a big program and a government solution. And for example, last year in the state legislature, there was a bill proposed called the Horizons Act. It would have created universal pre-K and really enlarged government to step into the role of the caregiver, of the mom who chose to stay at home, wanted to be a mother, but it stepped in and it would subsidize taking children out of the household and providing government support for that. That was sexy, if you will, when it came to a policy solution for a very real need that was there. So how do we parlay what you're saying, incentivizing family formation, incentivizing maybe stay-at-home moms? How do we make that more attractive on a large scale where people say, yeah, that makes sense, and yeah, that's what I want? Any ideas as to how to do that?
I think you're asking a deep question here, maybe above my pay grade. However, what I would say is we need to model this in our own homes, in our own political leaders. I was so thankful when I was watching the inauguration, seeing, for instance, J.D. Vance with his wife there and his young children. And there was all these political commentators saying the children were disruptive or unruly, whatever it is. No, they're children. And it is good for society to see, for the American people to see what an intact, loving family looks like and how much joy there is. We are such a divided, fractured culture. And I'm fairly confident that one of the main drivers is because of the disintegration of our families, of our marriages. And so modeling that, you know, demonstrating that, but also, you know, recognizing, I think you just go upstream and again, just look at what are we trying to promote as the American ideal. And for far too long, I think the American ideal has been sort of the self-made man, you know, delaying marriage, delaying, you know, settling down or whatever, what have you. And you have to go to the big city and, you know, make it big and, you know, establish your fortune, experience the American dream. And then you come back and you start, you know, getting married and having children. And what many people don't realize, number one, it doesn't always work that way. Number two, there's a biological clock that is ticking. And so as we delay marriage, this is one of the reasons why our birth rates are in such decline because of the delay of marriage, specifically women delaying marriage. And then they think it fertility is just a switch that we've kept off for, you know, a decade or more. We just flip it on. And then, you know, whenever I want to get pregnant, I can just automatically get pregnant. Doesn't work that way because we've been telling our bodies for a decade plus, I don't want to have a child. Now I want to have a child. And so now what do we have? We have all kinds of expenses pouring into procreative technologies, you know, technologies that assist reproduction. Well, guess what? If we didn't delay marriage, if we promoted getting married young, settling down, having a family, how much more could the U.S. economy even save on those kind of expensive reproductive technologies and that money and that research be poured into some other beneficial pursuit? So I really do think these are all connected. You know, we've talked about it several times. We've alluded to it. The breakdown of the idea of mankind being male and female, that is the logic. There's two, male, female. That's the logic of the design of marriage, why marriage is complementary, why it's a man and a woman. Why is there only two? Because there's only two sexes, man and woman. And marriage is the building block of family, which is the building block of human society. So when you lay that all out, you see how pernicious the last 4, 8, 16 years have been that have come directly at the idea of us created as male and female. There's, you know, hundreds of genders, or gender exists on a spectrum, or we can change our genders. All of those ideas, guess what, have consequences for marriage and family. And we need to, as the church, speak up.
Colin Smothers, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters, and thank you all for tuning in, and join us next time.